Remember when you were a kid, and just about everything you ate was new and strange and potentially gross? I mean, olives, yuck. Spinach, disgusting. Broccoli, ew. Well, now we've learned to eat and even like those things. Dinner is safer and also a little more boring. Journalist Krista Weil wanted to see if she could recapture the thrill of eating on the edge. She's a fan of extreme sports, and she set out to make eating one of them. For the past few years, she's traveled around the world tasting every bizarre, repulsive, and downright dangerous food she could find. You can read about her adventures in her book Fierce Food, a catalog of the truly astonishing things people eat.
People get bored with the same kinds of foods day in and day out, and you'll find situations where people are eating things that are deliberately rotten, and you think, well, why would anybody ever do that? And I believe that that sort of came about as a result of just sheer boredom, and it's a slightly different flavor. It's a very strong flavor, and if it didn't kill you, it's something that you adapted to eating, and the taste that might have seemed very strange to the uninitiated palate became something that became a cultural lodestone, really, and something that people began to look forward to eating because they grew up with it, and it was a variation on a theme that was enjoyable for that very reason.
Give me an example. You must have several that are like that. What in Japan, for instance, is a cultural food?
I think that the number one example in Japan is a dish called natto, which are soybeans that have been allowed to ferment with a bacteria that originally was found in straw. So the idea is that at some point in the dark mists, somebody left a pot of cooked bean curds in straw or near straw, and the straw bacteria infiltrated the beans, and it created this kind of fermentation which resulted in, frankly, a very slimy kind of mucus that grew on the beans and imparted a very, very strong, you might say, ammoniac kind of flavor to them. And today, natto is an incredibly popular dish in Japan. You can buy it really on any street corner. It's not gourmet. It's something that's served in Denny's, in the Tokyo Denny's for breakfast. You can order natto. And it's kind of amazing because it's just, you know, you lift up the beans and these billows of kind of, well, it's like slime, really. And these billows of slime just blow off in the wind. And you put it in your mouth and you sort of get whacked with that flavor and just think, I don't know how this ever happened, that this food came about, but a Japanese person will, you know, you mention natto and this huge smile will spread across their face because it's beloved there.
You had the same sort of thing. Where was Iceland? You have the shark meat?
Yeah, the hákarl. Yeah, this is shark meat that if it were eaten sort of unprepared properly, it would make you very sick because it has a lot of urea. So somehow somebody, again, back in the history of time, evolved a manner of preparing this meat so that it could be eaten, which is you bury it in the beach, under the beach gravel for several months, in which time bacteria set in that ferment it or possibly rot it. There is actually a difference, and I'm not quite remembering at this moment which of the two it is. But in any case, it gets
hard. I have a feeling
again.
It's important to remember at some point if you're actually going to
eat
it.
Well, I was corrected once. No, it's not rotten. It's fermented. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I've made a big mistake. But anyway, it smells very bad when it's dug up. And in order to alleviate that somewhat, it's hung to dry for another few months in a windy shack. And then it's ready to be consumed.
The windy shack is the important part, isn't it?
And it still stinks. And it still tastes god-awful. But Icelanders eat it as part of this Viking celebration that they have at the end of January. And it's consumed in tiny little cubes, innocuous-looking pink cubes, and downed with tons and tons of caraway liqueur. And, you know, it reminds everybody of the Viking ancestry, and it's a wonderful national food, but apparently nobody really likes it. They eat it, they drink, and it's just done because it's done.
What is, do you think, the most disgusting thing you've eaten?
Well, the giant water bug was right up there, but that was sort of most bad before I ate it, just because of the way it looked. While I was eating it was a Swedish variation on the rotten shark theme, which is rotten herring in a can called surströmming. And it's, again, it's a national dish. There's great pride attached to it. And the funny thing is you can buy it sort of in any major food or fish cellar in the autumn months, and you allow it to ferment further. So you have a can in your fridge that is literally expanding and blowing up.
That's wrong.
It is wrong. You grow up and you hear that, no, that bulging can, you've got to call the manager in aisle three. There's something wrong here. You know, it can kill you. But they like that in Sweden. So the can is sort of blowing up and blowing up. And finally it gets to the point where you're really at risk of blowing out your entire fridge with surströmming, and that means a new fridge. So you have to open it up, and you do so in a can of water because apparently, well, I know this for a fact, the smell is so very bad that the can needs to be submerged so that the gas is contained in another medium besides air. And this...
You probably want to do this outside, too.
Well, it's food that must be eaten outside, yeah. And even so, it's unbelievable when you open that thing up and it fizzes.
Did it taste good?
The taste is absolutely appalling. Again, this is something that is consumed with a great deal of, in this case, vodka, usually Absolut for national pride's sake. And it's something that people have grown up with, and so therefore, you know, they're a little bit inoculated against it. But boy, I had my first surströmming. It was last year, outdoors in Hampstead Heath here, which is one of the largest parks in London, just to be sure that it got nowhere near our kitchen. And every dog within a mile came running over to figure out what the heck was that smelled like that. So we were surrounded by yapping dogs, and just we had to triple wrap the stuff when it was finally, you know, sort of tasted and then, you know, said no more.
Now, there's some of these examples of fierce food where not only do you have to be concerned about what it smells like, but you have to be very, very careful, I gather, about how it's prepared. There's the famous one, the blowfish.
The fugu, yes. I had the pleasure of having this in Tokyo, and a few hundred people every year die in Japan from eating fugu. They tend to be home chefs because fugu chefs in restaurants go through about 2 years of training and then extensive licensing before they're allowed to serve. So they really do know what they're doing.
So you were comfortable sitting down to a...
I was overcomfortable sitting down. It was a beautiful restaurant and, you know, couldn't have been more elegant. This was going to be a 7-course fugu meal. Unfortunately, what happened was about midway through the third course, my hands went numb. And I thought, okay, this is it. I am going to receive a posthumous Darwin Award that my family is going to have to pick up. Somebody's going to have to explain this to my two children. What a stupid, stupid way to die. Because it does start that way. It's a nerve toxin. It causes paralysis and it spreads from your extremities basically to, you know, your chest and heart, and you stop being able to live, but you're conscious the entire time, which is another interesting factor. And it was about toward the end of course 7 that my fingers started tingling again, and I realized that the chef knew that I was there to write about the experience, and I guess he must have been an absolute genius because he managed to get a few molecules of toxin onto that fish and, you know, give me an experience, but he didn't kill me. And again, that's something that I'm not in a big hurry to try again because it's dicing with death, really.
Has it changed your attitude toward food?
What has changed is that I'm more likely now to go into a restaurant and try something that I've never had before, just for the sake of seeing whether I like it or not. I would tend to stick with my, you know, sort of old favorites prior to writing this book. But it has made me more adventuresome, I'd say. And I know that the benefit is there's always the next meal. If I didn't like this particular one, I just won't finish it. I'll have a nice dessert and, you know, try again the next one.
Journalist Krista Weil is the author of Fierce Food, The Intrepid Diner's Guide to the Unusual, Exotic, and Downright Bizarre. A root beer for breakfast. Hey!